On RTE Radio 1 now, Arts Tonight, presented by Vincent Woods.
Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. On the programme, Doris Lessing carving a place in literature's Mount Rushmore.
It's not a question of choice, is it? It's what I've done. I don't... What else could I have done, given the fact I had no education? Virginia Woolf once pointed out that writers were very privileged because all they need is a biro. She's a pencil and an exercise book. It'd been pretty tragic if I had talent for being a painter, wouldn't it, when I had no money at all?
On becoming a writer, the voice of Doris Lessing, one of the great writers of the past half century who died last month. Lessing, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2007, was the oldest winner of that honour and only the 11th female winner in its 104-year history. Her groundbreaking novel, The Golden Notebook, published in 1962, 45 years earlier, was commended as a pioneering work that belongs to the handful of books that informed the 20th century view of the male-female relationship. And she was described as a writer of scepticism, fire and visionary power. From the publication of The Grass is Singing in 1960 through the Children of Violence sequence, novels like The Good Terrorist and The Fifth Child, and a series of space fiction novels, Lessing was constantly ploughing new ground, championing feminism and Marxism, later questioning and rejecting practically every ism she had earlier embraced. Publishing more than 50 books, she influenced and inspired a generation of young writers. In paying tribute to her, Margaret Atwood said that if there were a Mount Rushmore of 20th century authors, Doris Lessing would most certainly be carved upon it. Joining me to remember Doris Lessing are writers Eilidh Na Gcuimhne and Anne Haverty, and we'll hear throughout this programme extracts from an interview Theo Dorgan conducted with Doris Lessing for the RTE Books Programme imprint in 1999. Eilidh Na Gcuimhne, Doris Lessing, this powerhouse of literature and life, so powerful in fact, that and such a presence that it's almost hard to believe she's gone. I mean, this extraordinary writer of ideas.
Yes. Well, she's not gone, because of course her books are with us, and it seems to me that she was always part of the zeitgeist, almost, that the even if you hadn't read her, that you were going to be influenced by Doris Lessing back in the 70s when I was sort of coming of age as a writer and so on and so forth. Yeah, she was a tremendous writer of ideas, driven from the very first, her very first book, The Grass is Singing, by a huge mind. I think she was seems to me to be one of the most intelligent writers that I can think of.
Anne Haverty, the biographer Michael Holroyd said that Doris Lessing's contribution to literature was outstandingly rich and innovative, and her output constituted a chronicle of our times. And I think that's very accurate, you know, because she was so diverse and broad in the range of her themes, and she really did seem to capture a line of time.
Yes, I mean, she does say that this was her whole purpose in writing The Golden Notebook, that she wanted to encapsulate the thinking of her period in the same way that, you know, she would have liked to have known the sort of the, to dissect, to have a dissection, such dissections of 19th century thought, for example. And that book, The Golden Notebook, is, you know, probably the most comprehensive encapsulation of 20th century thought and I suppose, events as well.
And I want to talk in some detail about The Golden Notebook later, and we'll hear Lessing herself talking about it, because it is an extraordinary work, and I suppose it's maybe the novel that most people know best from her output, and a very diverse output it was. But Eilidh, going back, you mentioned her first novel, The Grass is Singing, published in 1960, set in Rhodesia, the Rhodesia of her childhood. And it remains this vivid and memorable picture of a completely changed world. But it's also very interesting because, you know, even as a relatively young writer, this is her first novel, she could make a central character who wasn't really all that likeable sympathetic to the reader.
It's a fantastically impressive achievement as a first novel, and really is testament to the genius that Doris Lessing was. It's a conventional novel by comparison with in its shape, and she was probably influenced by, you know, Tolstoy and 19th century novels and so on, or the ordinary realistic novel of the 20th century. So as far as its form is concerned, there isn't really you know, that much new in it, but it's a wonderful portrait of life in Rhodesia at the time. I mean, what was called the colour bar, the racism. Her feminism is there to some extent, even though it's an anti-heroine that she has in the book. It's about many people have read this one as well, and it's a good. Actually, it's not a bad one to start with, her first. But her anti-heroine Mary Turner is the most dislikable woman who has, I guess, all the prejudices of her race, the colonizers, the colonials in Rhodesia and in Africa. But nevertheless, even though she behaves in the most awful way towards her servants and her friends and everything, you empathise with her, you sympathise with her. So already Doris Lessing was able to create this extraordinary character of whom you would be very critical. But on the other hand, you can understand where she's coming from and what drives her. And she's a kind of trapped woman.
Heroine, anti-heroine, and Martha Quest, as was another of Lessing's great creations, and those novels are quite remarkable. We hear Lessing in a little while talking about Martha Quest, but remind us of that character and what she carries through Lessing's vision.
Well, she's a very young woman, a remarkably young woman when the novel starts. And yet she's got this, she's living in Rhodesia with her family, who are sort of rather limited colonial types. And she, her whole purpose is to escape from her milieu. But she has a wonderfully sort of mature and knowing faculty already. I mean, she is, you know, she's no kind of innocent or no sort of naive teenager. She's got this marvelous sort of, steely humanity about her already. I also want to say about that novel that it brings out something, I think, in Doris Lessing that maybe is a little absent later on. And I, in a way, I blame her, the fact that she went to live in London on this, Martha Quest has a sort of a wonderful descriptive and power and poeticism almost about Africa. And I can say that perhaps because I read when I was very young, that in a way it influenced my whole view of Africa and what it is. And even now when I look back and when I look at it again, you can the whole colour and intensity of Africa is there, and I think perhaps she found London and England a very mild and rather banal place in comparison, which does tend to seep into her books.
I think that's very true, and I think the curious thing is, although you would never talk of Doris Lessing as a writer who had a sense of place, in the sense that we Irish writers seem to always have that, like Edna O'Brien or John McGarren or something. The African novels do have that, and you're there. And as you say, and I never think of her as a poetic or metaphorical sort of writer, and I think that's why her short stories are often not very good. It seems to me don't quite work. They're kind of a bit journalistic or something. But there's a dryness, all right, about the later writing that isn't there in the early writing. And the descriptions of Africa, of the veldt, and of, these beautiful white millions of butterflies on the grass, and all, that's there in the Martha Quest novels and in The Grass is Singing, and then it disappears actually later. Yes. Except maybe in maybe the Black Notebook,
well,
you get
actually
some
in,
of the images do return, yeah. but she seemed to lose that kind of poetic streak that she had by nature, one might say, or certainly when she started off.
It does pop up again in The Summer Before the Dark, which is largely set in London. But when the protagonist goes to Spain, she goes to Spain with a younger man, with having a kind of love affair, but not really. Once again, this intensity appears, and I think it appears with the son. In fact, mm-hmm. you know, I think she had a
surprising.
Yes, exactly.
I think
we can all understand that.
Absolutely. Let's hear Doris Lessing herself talk about Martha Quest and those novels.
I think Martha Quest was an act of self-definition, and I think a lot of women's first early writing is that. It was not true of the Grass is Singing, which was not at all autobiographical. Mm. But Martha Quest was, and some of the short stories.
And did you think of those early novels, you deal with topics like social injustice, racial inequality, these things outside of the self. Did you think you were writing novels of ideas?
No, you forget I was writing about what I'd been brought up in, and I wasn't saying to myself, well, the grass is singing, now I'm writing a novel about the colour bar. That's a phrase that's gone with the wind. Mm. I was describing what I knew. So then later you think, oh, yes. Well, I had to say, my God, this is what it's about, because people were so angry. See, the whites in southern Rhodesia were furious. And on the other hand, all the comrades were furious because it wasn't the party line. And they said it was all Freudian. I hadn't read Freud at that time. So I really got a lot of stick over the grass of singing one way or another. And that's very good because you get tough and you get thick skin, which is very essential for a writer.
What does that shelter? What does that thick skin shelter?
Oh, the ability not to be swayed by every breath of criticism. That's very good.
Because you talk on and off in your life with more increasing frequency into the 60s and 70s of keeping this kind of moving point of consciousness going, of keeping it protected. Do you think there is a place in yourself where you're conscious of the world that needs to be sheltered almost from what you do?
Yes, but it is sheltered. It's unassailable. No one can get at it. This is a true freedom, that knowing that nothing in the world can reach you, doesn't matter what it is.
Anne Haverty, that's very interesting, you know, the idea of this being a work of self-definition. And she's so precise about that and making that distinction between The Grass is Singing and then these novels where she really did seem to go on that journey of self-definition. And I suppose in a sense, so much of her, the trajectory of her work can seem like that, that she was constantly searching, constantly making things new and in a way almost seeming to define herself through her work. And yet it's much more than that, too.
Yes, I mean, all the themes that you see in Martha Quest crop, you know, there they are again in The Golden Notebook, again in some of the later novels such as The Summer Before the Dark. The woman who is seeking to define herself through the culture of her time and usually failing to fit into that culture. But not because she's unable to particularly, but because it doesn't satisfy her. She can see through it. She can see the falsities, how conventions define people without them examining this phenomenon or investigating it. And whereas Martha, as of course famously Anna does endlessly in The Golden Notebook, is on a quest to break through all those conventions, expectations and prejudices and find out who she is, who she might be.
I suppose we don't often think of Doris Lessing as being particularly humorous or playful, and yet we saw this gesture several years ago where she played with her publisher, submitting a novel under the pseudonym of Jane Summers,
yes.
And it was rejected by the publishers as a pale
yes.
imitation of Doris Lessing.
Yes, what other writer in the world would do such a thing and then go public on it afterwards? And I think that's an example of how daring Doris Lessing was in every way, in her thought, in her writing and in her actions, experimenting and finding out what would happen. And that was a very comforting thing, I think, for writers, starting off and so on, to hear about that the great Doris Lessing's work was rejected by her own publisher. I think it does encapsulate something of her irreverence, yeah, for the conventions and yeah, her ability to see through them and to question them, which is what, yeah, is a defining feature of her life and writing and thinking from the word go, actually. She's always, the characters in the novels are always on the margins, aren't they? They're kind of, I mean, they're, well, they're active politically and that, yeah, but they're still slight outsiders. They're, well, outsiders.
They hold back, don't they? They tend to be engaged, but at the same time to maintain a sort of detachment.
They analyse.
Yeah, I think another thing that that might be a comfort to writers is, as she says herself, that she had no education. And it's true. She had really no education whatsoever. I mean, in our terms, she seems to have hardly even had a Leaving Cert, let alone a degree or postgraduate degrees. And yet, she is a wonderfully intellectual writer. So, you know, I think that, you know, must show us that writers don't have to be conventionally educated.
They don't have to be conventionally educated, but of course she was self-educated because she read everything, and she was educated by the party, wasn't
she?
Yes.
And educated
and
to the point where she could see through it.
Companions,
yes. Yes, but this,
yeah,
it was almost voluntary, you know, she was sort of seeking. She sought out herself her own education, I suppose. I mean, it's not true to say she wasn't educated in that sense, but she did. She sought out her own education in the way that it, you know, in a manner that drew her.
Yeah, the Academy of Life,
she
was hard work.
Yeah, I suppose again her unconventionality might have been defined by that, even from the word go. She left school when she was, I don't know, 15 or some such age.
I have to say that I haven't read her cannabis science fiction novels, or space fictions, as she preferred to term them. But apparently they were the work of which she said she was most proud. So I suppose that's something one would have to rectify. But here she is talking a little about that work.
I don't think all human beings are the same. You know, I think that there are human beings of many different kinds. I think that I think it is possible that we are some kind of vast experiment, and I've written about this not quite on that level in the Syrian experiments. It's quite, why not? Why should we think that we are self-propelled? I think we're very conceited. We imagine that we decide the course of our lives and our cultures, and I don't think it's necessarily true.
The voice of Doris Lessing there. Very interesting that. I mean, I know, Ailish, you read and reviewed one novel roughly in that terrain, The Cleft.
Yeah, The Cleft is a founding myth novel. It seems to be about jellyfish or blob, female jellyfish who are the origin of the species, and they live in a cleft on a rock, and the idea is that and they reproduce. It's in a sense feminist, and on the other hand questioning feminism, in that it's about, you know, how these female blob like creatures are completely independent of males and can reproduce themselves, but then as the novel moves on they encounter problems, and in the end it's male-female world. I didn't enjoy it very much, I have to say, and reviewed it kind of negatively at the time. But as you say, I would feel I should revisit the space fiction and the various things just to understand Doris Lessing's thought in these areas. I feel now actually that I am so conventional that I prefer the earlier realistic novels, that's a sign of a kind of weakness in me, whereas she's moving on into the Golden Notebook itself is quite experimental in form and is a kind of postmodernist novel, and then she goes on into this science fiction or space fiction or whatever you want to call it, and does all kinds of weird and wonderful things with literature. But in a way she's almost avant-garde and ahead of her time, and going in, you know, before I think the computer games and the sort of fantasy literature that is becoming more and more popular among young people, that, you know, Doris Lessing at the age of about 70 is there before them doing it and using it as a vehicle for her very interesting and advanced ideas about humanity, about her philosophical ideas. What are we doing? Where are we going? I mean, she's quite environmentalist, really, as well. She takes on all the big... So many writers that we know and love work like Jane Austen, I guess, on a little piece of ivory on a small canvas. And maybe that's where the most successful novels and fiction really do work. But Doris Lessing takes on the whole world and beyond. I mean, she's off into outer space.
There is a sense, do you think... in which she kind of left individuals in the individual dilemmas and, you know, the sort of the small concerns of humanity behind at a certain point. I mean, she had examined them so closely. She had been so engaged with them, really, through her political work and her political thought. And even very early on, there is this sort of sense of almost... disengagement from them, fatalism about them, that humanity will keep on making mistakes and doing dreadful things and probably annihilating itself in some dreadful war. And that really, I think she lost any sort of optimism. I don't mean that in that she became pessimistic necessarily, but developed this very... this strong detachment or overview of it, and sort of then went into the cosmic world, really, to feed her imagination.
But I think it's also a measure of her fearlessness that she was prepared again to defy expectation and literary fashion and go into this realm. And as you're saying, Eilish, you know, it seeming to anticipate a part of the future, the immediate future. Not to say what might come later, but she seems to have this extraordinary sense. You know, again, that citation from the Nobel Committee saying that she had a visionary power, a fire and visionary power, and certainly that visionary power seems apparent in those novels of space and time, and coming back again to the notion of her as a novelist of ideas, perhaps much more ever than a stylist. That she was somebody exploring ideas.
Yeah, she's exploring ideas even from the very beginning, where she is actually a more impressive stylist, I think, in the early works maybe than in the latest. Yeah. It's as if Doris Lessing had so many ideas and so much to write about, to say that style becomes less important to her. I mean, I can't imagine her fiddling around for days with a sentence. And I was thinking of her in connection with an oft-quoted line from John McGahern, which is that a novelist's only business is to mind his sentences, which I think is only part of the truth, and that John McGahern knew that very well himself too. Unfortunately, there is much more to it than that. But I just can't imagine Doris Lessing. I would just feel she would look on that as a rather trivial way to that there are so many more important things, like, you know, the future of the world and where we fit into the universe and so on.
I think she was essentially a philosopher, really. I mean, that was her bent, that was her interest. And she used writing and novels as vehicles for expressing what she was thinking about greater issues.
Indeed, yeah. But she also says a very interesting and, I think, correct thing about the novelist's task, which it is to portray life as it is around her at the time. And I suppose, you know, if we were analysing what made Doris Lessing a writer, I mean, it probably was being in that crucible of politics and racism and everything that was Africa when she was there.
The seeking after truth, represents.
Yeah,
and the unflinching gaze before truths that most of us, or most writers, don't necessarily want to face.
Absolutely, because one of the things she says about Africa and Rhodesia and the colonial experience in her time is that, you know, the people that were around her could not foresee the end of this. And I mean, the end was about to happen. And she saw the end of then also Marxism and Russia and the many ideologies and huge movements that seemed so permanent to those who were involved and caught up in them at the time. So that I think that that really is something that has driven her thought too, that she knows, because we can't, it's so hard for us to, you know, it's so hard for the Romans to really understand. They don't know that the Roman Empire is going to end. But Doris Lessing knows all this, it seems.
Yeah. And was never afraid to admit that she had been wrong. You know, that she'd been wrong in her immersion in communism. And she was unflinching in that way. She's not afraid to face up to herself. I suppose, again, and you were saying, you know, not primarily, but we should think of her also as a philosopher. But she also, of course, wrote poetry. She wrote autobiography. And she wrote two librettos for operas by Philip Glass based on those space fiction novels. And let's hear a little music from one of those, from the making of The Representative for Planet 8. The music of Philip Glass from the Doris Lessing opera, as it were, the making of The Representative for Planet 8. You're listening to Arts Tonight. Our guests, Eilish Ní Chaoimhne and Anne Haverty, and we're remembering Doris Lessing and her writing. On Arts Tonight, we're looking at the work of the late Nobel laureate Doris Lessing, who died last month. Eilish Ní Chaoimhne, The Golden Notebook, we've referenced it a few times, probably her best known and most celebrated work. Remind us what that book explores and, I suppose, the intricate nature of its structure.
It has quite a complex structure. Let's see if I can get it right. There's a kind of frame novel, Free Women, and which focuses on the life and experiences of a woman, a writer called Anna Wolfe, who is experiencing a kind of breakdown, and lives in London. And Anna keeps notebooks, four notebooks, which in which she writes all kinds of things. A blue notebook. A red notebook in which she describes events and ideas relating to communism. A black notebook, which is about the apartheid and the black situation. And finally, there's a golden notebook in which everything. There's a kind of state of harmony between the sexes is achieved, and a general kind of harmony. I think that's not a terribly good description. But
well, it sounds. I mean, it's more difficult to describe than it is to. It's not difficult to read, in fact.
No, it's quite accessible.
Very accessible, and as a structure, it is very new, isn't it? Like, I don't think that sort of. Using these different notebooks as means of expressing the sort of the different aspects of somebody's life, which is a very big theme of hers, that we all play roles all the time, and we produce different aspects of ourselves depending on the situation in which we find ourselves.
And it's very interesting. I remember reading The Golden Notebook in the late 70s and really being immersed in it and very glad to be, but also finding it new, and I was quite surprised then to discover that it had been published, I think, was it in 1962?
Yeah.
It still felt new, in the late 70s somehow, or at least it did to me. And I suppose, again, that's a measure of what she was doing, of her ability as an innovator as well in literature.
It still seems new, actually. It still seems, as she says, it's got such vitality. And I think it's that vitality that makes it seem very new. And also the fact that it's so fiercely, searingly honest, you know, about, especially about the men-women relations, that inevitably anyone telling a truth will always seem new, you know. And I think it always will seem new because it's so elusive, that quality in, you know, in people, and sadly.
Yeah, I mean, Doris Lessing saw it as a novel about fragmentation and breakdown, personal and political, and it deals with the falling apart of communism and the whole dream of that dream, as well as Anna Wolf's personal sort of breakdown. But as she says, people it seemed to read into it what they want. And I suppose for us, for me, in the 70s, it did seem very modern, actually, because what I, and I think a lot of women of my generation, read into it was that it's a novel about women who are, you know, leading very independent lives, breaking away from the old structures, a feminist novel. And Lessing didn't like that view of it to some extent, which I find a little bit, I find her kind of repudiation of the feminism of the novel a bit hard to take, in a sense.
Yeah, well, I think maybe she meant that she wasn't presenting precepts or prescriptions for feminism. That in a way, you could almost claim it's anti-feminist, because it does, you know, it presents women engaging in subterfuges and deceptions simply to survive within relationships. But she doesn't ever say, she doesn't say they're wrong, and she doesn't say they're right. She doesn't say, well, this is what they should be doing. It's more that they are not being authentic a lot of the time. And the novel really is to me a kind of a search for authenticity within relationships and individually. Mm-hmm. And I also think, well, I remember finding it, did you find this, Eilish, slightly dismaying, you know, because I read it when I was very young, and these women were adults, you know, and first of all, it was a very adult novel, and they were, I suppose, in their 30s, they were very old, you know, very much older, mature women. And I remember being quite dismayed that this is what life was like, or this was what men and women were like together. You know, I didn't, you know, I it was, she spoke in ways that I didn't really want to know, actually.
There was certainly no idealization of life.
No,
And love and relationships.
No.
Let's hear Lessing herself talking to Theodorgan about The Golden Notebook.
Well, in the first place, it was one of the first feminist books, and it earned an enormous a lot of attacks. I was attacked a great deal. The word balls cutter was freely used. And it went on and on. And then, you see, suddenly it became a feminist book. None of these things interested me in the slightest. I was writing a book, I thought, about that particular time. I wanted to describe the way people were thinking at that particular time, because it had occurred to me that a great many novels were not written in the 19th century that I would like to have read. So I thought, I knew perfectly well I was living through something extraordinary, the collapse of communism, you know, as an idea. So I wanted to record it before it went. So I couldn't write it now. The atmosphere then was so tight and tense and embattled. Well, that's gone. We're living in a very oozy time, aren't we?
Something funny happened then too, because it was taken up as a feminist text, which for a limited period in history, seems to me, it was, in sense, in terms of the development of feminism. But the book's ambitions continue to go out beyond that. I mean, they resist isms. There are paradoxes in what happened to people in that book that I still haven't puzzled out. The trouble with isms is that they can prison the book, can't they?
So I've always had three kinds of letters about that book. One is the feminist letter. The other is letters about mental illness, and I still get them because, you know, it's about breakdown of ideas and health, and then, of course, about politics. And a letter I get regularly is from men who say, I've just given the golden notebook to wife, girlfriend, daughter, whatever, to try and broaden her mind a little. This always makes me laugh.
And what do you think they mean by that?
Maybe they weren't interested. I don't know what. I had a letter from a man in Mexico the other day who said, I read your The Golden Notebook with great interest because I thought women only were interested in babies and cooking. And now I know that then that's not true. So this book has got a great life of its own. I'm always amazed at it.
Do you ever feel it was became a millstone in some way?
Well, I do get a bit cross when people talk as if I've never written anything else, but which I think is perhaps wrong. No, I'm fascinated by this book. Yeah. One, because I couldn't possibly write it now, and secondly, because it's got this extraordinary vitality, yeah. Which is amazing. It turned up in Rio when I was there. There was a certain hotel where they have tarts outside, and the girls sit around. And one of them leaned across and said, I love you. And I thought, my God, what's this? Then her girlfriend said, no. She wanted you to know she loved The Golden Notebook. She was a girl from the favelas, you know. Yeah. This, I thought, was probably the most wonderful thing that's ever happened to me.
Doris Lessing there talking to Theo Dorgan on the programme Imprint from 1999. Amazing to hear that conversation. And, you know, here she is, it's 1999, and she's talking about the collapse of communism and seeing that happen in the 50s. You know, so again, she's, you know, 30 years ahead of it all. Mm-hmm. But also the her ability to celebrate the book, even though she feels, you know, maybe sometimes people don't see that she's written so much more, but you know, she says that she's fascinated by it, and it's I think it's a terrific insight into Lessing herself to hear all that.
I think what comes across to me in this great interview by Theo Dorgan of Doris Lessing is her, her niceness almost, and her ability to accept everything that's thrown at her, whether it's negative criticism, which she got plenty of in connection with The Golden Notebook, but also with many of her other later books, or you know, people interpreting her work in whatever way they please or so on. There's a great kind of, maybe it's the mellowness of old age, because I would have thought of Doris Lessing as being a rather edgy, prickly sort of a person, but there's a great calmness about her, isn't there?
Yeah, she's very calm, very steady. She says somewhere that in fact, you know, what was most important in her life, ultimately, was Sufism. Mm. And I think she discovered that sort of calmness and serenity, probably through her religious searchings, her meditations. As far as I know, Sufism is a lot about meditation. She seems to look on the world with a very indulgent and forgiving eye, despite everything.
She would never be self-effacing, but she seems to have, you know, almost understate her powers all the time. She's like, I'm just describing the way people think at this time, you know. But I mean, what sort of people are most people aren't thinking at all any time? And really, in The Golden Notebook, it's full of people having big long conversations and dialogues and debates about really important issues.
It makes you wistful, really, doesn't it? Yes. For those times when you felt that people were really actually thinking and talking about their thoughts,
yeah,
in a way that I don't think we do anymore.
No.
I mean, we seem to have much less to think about and much less to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as she says, it's we live in oozy times
or woozy times
or something.
She's pretty critical of the internet as well. And she used the Nobel Prize speech to talk about global inequality and also the way storytelling and literature is treated now. It's very interesting. It was called On Not Winning the Nobel Prize. So here it was again, an opportunity. She wasn't afraid to take the opportunity to say what she wanted and to say something maybe a little bit awkward and against the grain. I'm just wondering, did she...
It had very little that was personal in it, the speech. It was all about the need for books, the desire for books, you know, the people who have no access to books. And really, she herself hardly appeared in that speech at all, which was, again, very, you know, that kind of wonderful sort of self-abandonment in a way that she developed, I think.
It must be pretty rare for a Nobel Prize speech to have an absence of the person who's receiving it. I'm just wondering, did you know, were either of you kind of consciously influenced as writers by Lessing, by her writing, or maybe inspired, perhaps more accurately, perhaps were you inspired at all by her courage as a writer and her determination to carve her place?
I always find that question difficult about inspiration, because to me, I'm never really conscious of being inspired. Like, I'm looking at a blank page, I'm writing, and I don't really, I'm not consciously aware of having somebody at my shoulder or what may be influencing me or inspiring me. But I have absolutely no doubt that having read that at an early age, I mean, the Golden Notebook. Those early novels, that I imagine I may have, assumed a sort of an attitude to writing that, you know, I hope is with me still, that it should be truthful, that it should be stringent, that it should reflect, life as it is lived in a particular time, that it should be vital and vivid. You know, she's not the only one who has these qualities, of course, but she has them, you know, in those early books, she has them all together in one. And I'm sure I must have been influenced.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't have seen her as a direct influence, but I think indirectly she definitely was an influence, because I was influenced by writers who were influenced by her. I really do believe that she was very much not just part of the zeitgeist, but central to the zeitgeist for women writing in the 60s, 70s and thereafter. So her observations that the writer is trying to capture what life is like at a particular moment in time, absolutely would be an influence on my writing. I think there were many women writers were kind of coming into their own just at around that. Yeah, she starts in 1962. I mean, that's everything in the world, it seems to me, to change in the 60s and the 70s. Yeah, 70s here, but 60s over there. and I think and obviously the idea that women's lives are worth analysing and exploring and writing novels about in great depth is an idea that has influenced me tremendously. Via more directly, I'd say some of her probably disciples, as I would see them, Margaret Drabble and Margaret Atwood and people like that, who kind of are doing similar, working in the same vein.
Because I'd quoted that great Margaret Atwood line about Mount Rushmore and how Lessing might have placed Rushmore.
Yes.
And you were saying that you felt that maybe of all the writers, Atwood is perhaps the one closest to Lessing.
Well, she's the first name that jumps into my mind when thinking of a writer who resembles Doris Lessing in her scope, in her intellectual capacity and attitude to writing, and in her interest in the big picture rather than in the person, rather than exclusively in the personal. It is Margaret Atwood, and she's also, I suppose, significantly and interestingly gone into the science fiction way of writing as well. There's this movement from realism and the huge interest in the individual into something more general and futuristic, and just thinking about where it's all going. She definitely would seem to be following the footsteps, are like Doris Lessing in some ways. By comparison, would say the recent Nobel laureate, whom I love more than Doris Lessing or Margaret Atwood, Alice Munro, whose focus is so kind of
Precise,
yes.
And you mentioned the Sufism there, and of course there is that strong spiritual instinct in some of Lessing's work, mediated through Sufism. And I think it was Joyce Carol Oates who quoted Walt Whitman in saying, that Lessing contained multitudes. That was she had the gift and grit to explore and express all of those. Here she is on her novel Briefing for a Descent into Hell.
I was writing a book about, this is a very 1960s book, you know, this when everybody was into wild experiences of one kind or another. And it occurred to me that the descriptions of people in prison camps who hallucinated and the people who were being inducted by shamans and people who hadn't eaten enough. There was a girl in my basement who was in love and she hadn't eaten anything for days and she was suddenly miles above Westminster Bridge, actually, looking down at herself. This kind of thing. And it occurred to me that this is probably all the same experience with different names. And then I knew psychiatrists at that time who said it was very common for patients to go through self-induced quest journeys, like if you're a Catholic, it would be the Stations of the Cross, or if you're various parts of the world have different journeys. So I thought I would use this in this idea.
Doris Lessing there, that notion again of the self-induced quest journeys seems to go to the heart of so much of her work. And again, one thinks of the name of the character of Martha Quest. I mean, this sense through so much of the work of questing. But what she mentioned there as well about the young woman in the flat who hadn't eaten, it makes me think of The Good Terrorist, that extraordinary later novel where she, I suppose, again, very bravely takes on this theme of how naive, youthful idealism can be hijacked, in a sense, for terror. And it's ahead of its time, really ahead of its time, whether it's the IRA or the Red Brigades or whoever. And it struck me, you know, reading that again, she was so courageous, you know, to never afraid to really look critically at what she might have embraced earlier, or as was a novel like The Fifth Child. And I know she was criticised a great deal for that, for bringing in this idea that, you know, a child may enter, a new child may enter a family and bring something something dark, something unexpected in an unpleasant way into life. So and she, that's what I keep coming back to, was Lessing's courage in not being afraid to take on difficult themes.
Not just in her novels, but even personally. You know that she... It reminds me that the woman she speaks of who didn't eat or something, and then she found herself on Westminster Bridge. She herself has said how she induced deliberately a kind of schizophrenia in herself by, as an experiment, by not eating or whatever, I can't remember, not sleeping, I think, for a few days. And she began to hear voices. And she said, well, it's rather dangerous. I wouldn't recommend it because it can be rather hard to come back from. And but that was very typical of her, that she was fearless in her own life as well as in writing.
Something I think was it Martin Amis, I think, who in comparing Lessing to J.G. Ballard, and it's something, it touched on something you'd mentioned later, he said that she'd turned from, whereas Ballard had turned from navigating outer to inner space, Lessing went in the opposite direction, moving from social realism to outer space and, you know, space or science fiction. And it does seem that, you know, she was moving towards the expansive and yet holding all the time to almost deeply political themes, even if you think of the environment as being political and in a sense, I suppose we must. That, along with the kind of, you know, with the Sufi spiritual strain, is such a strong instinct through that later work.
She always saw, she was very interested in endings, you know, in sort of beginnings and endings. You know, she kind of went, you know, as time went on, these were became her points of reference, really. And she had this, I think, a very, you know, apocalyptic view of things, which is partly rooted in her childhood, I think, because her father, who had been wounded in the First World War, made was traumatized clearly and made the war very, very present to her. So she grew up with this sense of imminent war, war always behind you and in front of you. And I think that, you know, she always saw humanity as threatened by some, you know, catastrophe, calamity, and probably that one, that a similar kind of one that had happened maybe in the distant past and would be repeated. And, you know, she had that that kind of very, very long view of things.
And of course, again, we should say that she was born in Persia, that the, you know, as it was then. So it's interesting that later then she turns to Sufism, and it's as if there's this this turn of life in the film.
Yes.
Yeah. Moved to England and then to Rhodesia. But the other, I suppose, the other characteristic clearly was that she wasn't too easily impressed by anything, including, it would seem, winning the Nobel Prize in 2007. And her typically candid response to the news that she'd received the world's most prestigious literary award actually became something of a hit on YouTube.
We're photographing you. Have you heard the news?
No.
You've won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Oh, crap.
How do you feel?
What? Well, it's been going on now for 30 years. One can get more excited.
Okay. I'll ask you just one last question.
What?
Does it mean anything to win a prize? I mean, obviously, you don't write books.
I've won all the prizes in Europe. Every bloody one. So I'm delighted to win them all. It's a sort of a whole lot, okay? It's a royal flush.
Doris Lessing outside her home in London in 2007. Quite an extraordinary response to winning the Nobel Prize. Oh, Christ, she says.
It reminds me a little of what Beckett's wife, Suzanne, said when he won, when they got the news. And she said, quelle catastrophe, you know, what a catastrophe. And it's funny because in Beckett and Lessing seem to me to have quite a lot in common. You know, that way of looking at people almost nakedly and seeing them almost as specimens to be, you know, that move around in a kind of almost helplessly, at the mercy of forces, and that, you know, yeah, their kind of raw little humanity always being more apparent than their, you know, their individual sort of emotional states or dilemmas or
creatures in this habitat of life.
Mm, yeah. Exactly.
Seems like. As one thing that sticks out to me as well is, you know, she described herself as a writer who simply couldn't not write. And I suppose it's as good a summation as any, in a way, of somebody with that just that absolute commitment to doing what she did best.
I mean, she was clearly, what we call a born writer. It was in her bones, I suppose. And she was, it's hard, you know.
She seems to me to be actually the sort of person who could have done many things very well, even though she talks about her lack of formal education and all the rest as a handicap. So I kind of wonder, but yeah, she definitely was natural. She seems to be a natural writer because, again, her very first novel displays such enormous mastery of the form of the novel and great kind of inventive and imaginative and stylistic and analytic gifts that remained with her. And I'm always slightly suspicious when people say it's the only thing I could do. But on the other hand, I can never answer the question, why do particular people become writers? Yes.
She did say quite seriously, I could have been a doctor, which is interesting because, you know, she does have that impulse of sort of caring and pointing out to people maybe where they're going wrong. I mean, you know, she might have been very good at telling people what they should eat or, you know, their health might be improved by doing this or that.
I imagine she would have delivered a pretty effective anaesthetic as well. If you were, for anyone who hasn't read Lessing, I mean, what would you say they might begin with? I mean, would you think of The Golden Notebook? Would you think of The Grass is Singing, Children of Violence? Where would you tell people to start?
I think maybe Children of Violence, yeah. I mean, I love The Grass is Singing too. The Golden Notebook is probably becoming a harder novel for people to read now. I don't know.
I wonder. Yeah, I mean,
it's enormously long.
Yeah, for, and it's yeah. It's so uncompromising. It's so long, and it does require concentration. Probably that maybe in this age of the soundbite and Twitter stuff, that you know might be hard going for people, but I think it's so rewarding and so amazing that I would recommend that one.
Okay, there we leave it. Éirí Sin Gaoimhne and Anne Haverty, thanks to you both. The voice of Doris Lessing was from an interview with Theo Dorgan from the RTE imprint programme in 1999. The music was by Philip Glass from his opera based on Doris Lessing's work, one of the two. And Doris Lessing's novels, of course, and other writings widely available, and the best way to honour her memory, of course, to read her work. That's it from us. Next week, Galway's new Picture Palace cinema takes shape, and Rod Stoneman on his book Seeing is Believing the Politics of the Visual. Join us next Monday night at 10. Till then, good night.
Arts Tonight, presented by Vincent Woods, was produced by Aileen O'Mara for Digital Audio Productions.